Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to CSIS. My name is Peter DeShazo. I'm the director of the Americas program. Delighted to welcome you to this panel discussion of Cuba, specifically the topic Raul in Power, What to Expect. These are questions that many of us are asking. What does the future of Cuba hold under a Raul Castro government? What are the current conditions in the country in terms of any chance for political or economic change? What is the situation in Cuba, especially post-Hurricane Gustav? What are the variables that we should be tracking most closely as we move into more deeply an administration headed by Raul Castro? And of course, all of this coming on the eve of a change in government in the United States, a new administration, be it Republican or Democrat. It's a good time to be re-examining Cuba and re-examining the variables that will be at play in a Cuba to the degree that Cuba is or is not changing. We're very privileged to have with us today three leading experts on Cuba. We're going to begin with Professor Juan Del Aguila, who is an associate professor of political science at Emory University. You have the bio data, so I won't go into great detail on our three speakers, but Professor Del Aguila will go first. He'll be followed by Professor Anthony Capsia, who's the director of the Center for Studies on Cuba at the University of Nottingham in the UK, and then Marifeli Perez-Stable, who is vice president for democratic governance at Inter-American Dialogue. Following the presentations by our three experts, there'll be an ample opportunity for everyone to ask questions. So we'll begin with Professor Del Aguila. Juan?
Good morning. First of all, let me thank Peter and his staff, Jessica Horowitz, for scheduling this event and inviting me. It's always good to come to Washington. Just a short hop from where I live and work, state of Georgia, in the city of Atlanta. See some old friends in the audience. Good to see you. We've been limited to 20 minutes, which I think is great, so that we can then have questions from you. We've talked a little bit about the division of labor. In any case, what I want to start with is to give you some perspective on the early phase of consolidation, especially dating since the reorganization of the National Assembly, of the Council of State and the Political Bureau earlier this year, then make some comments about the economic and political significance of some of these reforms that have been announced. Maybe add a few comments about what I perceive to be Raul Castro's style, his temperament, how he is managing the government, the crisis, and so forth. I'm sure we'll have time for questions later. I'm going to quote from some of his speeches because I find that is also a good tool in letting the audience know what a policymaker or a leader says rather than filtering through my own eyes or through other sources. Coming out of the assembly meeting in February of this year, it is clear that the purpose of the reorganization of the Council of State and other major institutions, subsequently the Political Bureau of the Communist Party, was to surround Raul through promotions and changes in positions with mostly older, trusted, loyal military men, a few generals, but also keeping in the positions of leadership people like Carlos Laje and other people who have been at a fairly high level, so as to convey most of all, unity, generational unity, and political unity. It seems to me this was a critical signal that had to be sent, because there was a lot of speculation as to whether or not people from the second generation would be promoted to, for example, Laje was said to, was at times regarded as a possible prime minister, whatever that meant, as a possible first vice president. Well, that was not the case. The person who now is second in charge is an old Raulista, but someone on good standing on his own, who is 77 years old, José Ramón Machado. Subsequently, in April, May, there were promotions to the political bureau, which also signaled that the older generation would still be in charge, but that younger cadres, younger elements, people in their 40s and 50s, as I've alluded to, would also continue playing critical roles. It is true that the average age of the seven most powerful men is close to 70 years of age, but it seems to me that this was what needed to be done. This is what Raúl, it seems to me, preferred. Obviously, it had the approval of Fidel Castro, although he was not present when these changes were effected and announced, but they could not have taken place without his consent as well. In his speech, for example, to the plenary of the Central Committee of the Communist Party, Raúl reaffirmed the role of the Communist Party, quote, as the organized vanguard of the Cuban nation, placing the party in a position, quote, to meet future challenges and to ensure the continuity of the revolution when its historical leaders are no longer present. So there you have, I think, a succinct statement of this early phase of consolidation. We are not breaking up. We are united. We are certainly promoting old and trusted hands and general military people in particular. The younger generation may have to wait, but you'll get your shot at it at some future point. Okay. Subsequently, as you know, there has been an announcement that the 6th Congress of the Communist Party will be held, I think, in late 09, and presumably that will reaffirm the changes that have been made or new changes. I think one can expect new changes, especially in the political bureau. I don't have any particular idea just yet as to who may be promoted and who may be demoted, but clearly that is likely to be part of the agenda for that Congress. This, I think, also suggests, at least to me, that the regime is now fairly stable. It is, from a political sense, probably secure in its own standing, in its own status. I have not seen any evidence whatsoever of any real or internecine quarrels. There may be policy differences, but on the broad parameters of policy, domestic and foreign, they appear to be in agreement. There are reports about whether Raúl governs in a more collegial manner than his brother did, or whether or not he is, in fact, somewhat reluctant and prefers to stay behind the scenes and not give as many speeches or be as public with his speeches as his brother was. That's probably true as well. The reason that is, I think, is that Raúl knows that he simply does not have the political temperament to command the stage. Nor does he have the legacy and probably doesn't have the talent to command the stage as Fidel Castro once did. Fidel Castro is a histrionic personality. Raúl Castro is not a histrionic personality. He is a man who rose and has been in charge of military bureaucracies and the military, Minister of Defense, and so forth. And you see that formación, that attitude, that experience reflected in how he governs, in what he says, and most of all, in how he says it. In how he says it. Okay? Quickly, obviously we don't have much time. The what I perceive to be the economic strategy that has been laid out has one important or one crucial component, and that is to stimulate agricultural production, specifically food production. One of their ministers is on record as saying that food production is a national security issue. There's a question but that through a series, the command model, especially the command model in agriculture, has been a complete failure, and even reforms in the 90s, like these cooperatives, have not succeeded. So they're now going to plan C, which is to gradually lease some lands that are fallow, that are not productive, to small peasants and farmers, and getting them to produce directly for consumption, specifically to increase the food supply. I have some data that you may be interested in to sort of corroborate. Nearly 54% or so of Cuba's productive good land that is owned by the state is nonetheless not put to productive uses. It lays fallow. Raúl Castro, for example, has talked about this weed, this marabú, that appears to be taken over field after field after field. So one of the goals, it seems to me, is to streamline the agricultural sector of the economy to let private producers and farmers manage some of these lands and to encourage them to increase the production of food. This is what he said in one of the speeches that I'm quoting from. In relation to, quote, to one of the issues most raised in the meetings, food production and its high price. The country is working with the urgency that a vital matter requires, given its direct impact on the life of the population, above all on the people with lower incomes. And then he goes on to say, what particularly interests us is that the positive performance of macroeconomic indicators is reflected as much in the household economy. There is no better way to see that reflection than in increasing the food supply and the availability of other food-related items. There has been talk, for example, of either cashing or junking the ration card, which has been a bone of frustration and anger for many, many years now. There's been talk about that, but nothing that I know of, maybe Marifeli or Tony to getting rid of it altogether. I don't know whether they'll actually get to that, but at least it is being talked about. The final point that I want to make, or the final series of comments, is that one thing that stands out in the speeches that Raúl Castro has given, and has given several over the last year or so, and that clearly reflect his military background and his style of management, which appears to be clear-cut, direct, matter-of-fact, is that he sees, and I think he's quite alarmed at the lack of discipline that he finds in the workplace and in any other many other areas of social and economic life. In the speech on speech that I quoted from, he referred to the need for disciplines several times in consecutive paragraphs. Quote, good planning is most important and we cannot spend more than we have. We should organize things well, work in an orderly and disciplined fashion. I insist on the importance of discipline. What I mean is that we should all do what corresponds in the strengthening of discipline and social order. If we don't do it, our people stand to suffer the consequences. Still in the same speech. The lack of our history teaches us that the greater the difficulties, the greater the need for order, discipline, and unity. That is the new trilogy. Order, discipline, and unity as we confront these multiple crises on different fronts, and we always have to maintain our guard against prospective aggression and threats. Order, discipline and unity, whether it's in the selection of high-ranking members to the political bureau, whether it's in the streamlining of the agricultural and production systems. One has to insist on people getting back to the basics, getting back to work, and being disciplined about it. So, to sum it up, because I want to hear Marifeli and Tony too. This is a regime that is now, mostly preoccupied with not only managing the current crisis after the hurricanes, but with domestic affairs. Raul Castro, that is where his priorities lie, both for the short term as to the longer term. He is not interested, as far as I can see, as his brother was, in promoting regional and or world revolution. His speeches are matter of fact, clear, short, and often clearly lack the invective and anger and grandiloquent themes about socialism eventually triumphing over liberal democracy. He is of a different cast of mind, and he realizes that governing is managing, and managing itself will, how well he manages, will at the end of the day redound to his legacy. Muchas gracias.
Thank you very much, Professor Capsia.
Right, many thanks again for Peter for inviting me. And thanks, Juan, for setting the scene, because there are lots of themes to follow up there. We've only got 15 minutes, 20 minutes at the most, so I'll limit it to a few things and hope that some of the other things will come out of the discussion. The first thing I would stress, and it may seem an obvious thing to say, is avoid the obvious. When you're looking at Cuba, avoid the obvious. I think that's always been true. Throughout the 60s, 70s, 80s, I was saying, avoid the obvious, don't compare it to Eastern Europe. It simply isn't comparable. I would say now avoid the obvious, which is, for example, avoid talking about nothing but Fidel, and therefore equally avoid talking about nothing but Raul, because if it's not to say that those are not significant, but that if we focus on those two and nothing but, what you tend to miss is what's going on behind, what's going on with the others, what's going on in the system, and to talk about the system itself. And I think that's much more important than anything else. And I think if you focused on Fidel, for example, you got it wrong in 2006. The idea that, first of all, there would be a withdrawal, the idea that there would be a natural, easy succession, and that the whole thing would be done smoothly, took people by surprise, and it shouldn't have done. Frankly, it was, as you would say, a no-brainer that Raul would succeed. It was fairly obvious that the succession would be smoothly run and there wouldn't be blood on the streets. That was fairly clear. I actually have to say I pat myself on the back here as well, because we were talking before about predictions. I stuck my neck out in 2003 and in a public lecture predicted that Fidel would step down in 2009. I got it wrong by 1 year. Or three, depending on how you count it. The reason I thought that he would simply stand down, though, was because, first of all, my reading of the situation was that it was too dangerous to carry on when there were signs quite clearly setting in from 2001, 2002, that he was beginning to lose it. He was beginning to lose his touch. His speeches were much more disparate, were much less focused. And there were concerns among loyal Cubans that there might be an element of drift in government. There were concerns that expressed quite openly. And I thought for that reason it was very likely that he would step down. I have to say since then, from 2005, it became anyway much clearer that something was happening. And what I'm referring to are the strains which became evident in 2005. And there are two sorts of strains, but they're both related to the battle of ideas, which has been going on since 2000, which might be another topic for discussion, I don't know. This first set of strains applies to the commitment of the faithful, the foot soldiers in the battle, the ones on whom the system relies, the party members, the activists, the ones who really are called out every time there is a campaign, every time there is something, some crisis. I have to say, by 2005, they were exhausted. They were really exhausted and demoralized because it had been 5 years of just constant campaigning. And actually, you can go back to earlier periods in the revolution to find the same thing happening. The other set of strains, though, arising from the battle was that outside that, beyond the foot soldiers, the ordinary Cubans on the street were starting to complain about the costs of the battle, about the problems it was creating. And it was clear that something had to shift. And the way I read it at the time was that it was going to shift back to the other way of looking at things, the other way of running things. Now, that comes to the second major point I would focus on, which is the first was go beyond the obvious. The second is look at the system. How does the system actually operate and how has it operated? And what I would say in a nutshell is that the way the system's operated right from the start has been one of two types of political behavior, political involvement. The first is either mobilization, mass mobilization, passionate mobilization, active mobilization through campaigns, through rallies, through marches, getting the troops out, I mean the troops in inverted commas, getting the people out to attack a problem. And I think that has been quite consistently used over the years. But there are costs with that. Sometimes it works beautifully. Sometimes it really does do what it's supposed to do. But there are costs. The first cost is economic. Actually, it's not a very productive way of doing things economically, and there really are problems with that. The second is the cost on the, as I said, on the foot soldiers, the pressure that's put on them. The third cost, actually, is that the party gets neglected, and that really is a problem. Now, when this has happened in the past, the party has been neglected, and I think that's what happened in the 2000s. The alternative method is the Raoul preferred method, which is institutions, structures, systems, party, organizations. He is clearly an organization man, no question. He prefers organizations, believes in them, believes, incidentally, that they are more accountable. That's one of the interesting things there. It's not just efficient, but it actually works in working in as channels of communications. And I think, therefore, that the mobilization which got underway from 2000 was, by 2005, very, very costly and was starting to worry people. And I think, therefore, what began to happen from 2005 was a shift. Even before Fidel withdrew, there were signs already that the party was being strengthened once again. Now, the party, what happens to the party is really fundamental. Remember, it should have had its Congress in 2001, 2002, depending on how you count. The fact that it didn't take place was an indication that once again, as with all these periods of mobilization, it was being neglected. The party tended to exist as the Buro Politico or at the nucleus, the grassroots. In between, and as a national structure, it didn't quite work, and that presented challenges. But from 2005, you could see signs that it was actually changing at the middle level. People were being replaced, people were being moved into position. Now, I think for the first year after Fidel handed over temporarily to Raoul, there was a hiatus. There really wasn't much happening. There really were no decisions being taken for a long time because people weren't clear. Is it a Raulista system? Is it a Fidelista system? If so, which way is it going to go? No one was quite clear. From 2007, from July, from the July the 26th speech, it became absolutely clear. That's when the message went out to have the consultation exercise, which took place in the autumn that year, which was basically answering the question, what's wrong with us, what are we doing wrong, and what should we get right? It was a really fascinating exercise. I have to say I was there in the autumn watching that exercise take place. And what happened, quite simply, was all the organizations, not just the party or the youth wing of the party, the UJC, but also the mass organizations, were all enrolled in the task and people given the complete freedom to say, complain away, this is your opportunity. It really was very interesting, and there were some fortunate or unfortunate people who actually had five bites of the cherry, depending on how many organizations they belonged to. And I talked to people who actually did go to different experiences depending on which organization they were participating in. It was obviously partly to let off steam. It was partly to channel the frustrations. It was partly also to re-legitimize the system as a system, which had fallen into a little bit of disrepute. I think also, most fundamentally, it was actually to legitimize Raoul's reforms. He knew what people were going to say, and it was partly geared in that way, and therefore it gave him the ammunition to then start making the reforms that came out. Now, the second thing that happened after 2007, was the reinvigoration of the organizations, and particularly of the party. Juan referred to the fact that the party is now, Congress is now going to take place, definitely in late 2009. And I think that's important because we have to get away from, again, from the idea of the party not having any meaningful structure beyond Fidel's instrument or the Buro Politico. It actually is, remember, the way in which the activists of the system are trained, channeled, used, tapped. It's a very significant force for running the system, for running the whole structure. So when I keep referring to strengthening of the party, what does it actually mean? It means changing the personnel, and that's clearly taken up again from 2007. That's quite clearly happening. It means using it against corruption. Corruption is a worry. Juan referred to the indisciplina. Indisciplina is a catch-all term, but it includes corruption. And clearly there is a worry that if you reform too much economically, it's going to create some problems of corruption, which may well be endemic lower down the system. We don't want them to get higher than that. And so the party is clearly seen as a major weapon against that. I think also there's a question of re-legitimizing the party, making the party something that actually listens to people and responds, which, of course, if it's not meeting, it doesn't. That's one of the problems. And getting a debate moving. One of the things we always overlook in Cuba is the extent of the debate that actually takes place behind closed doors, inside organizations. There is a huge debate going on at the moment and has been going on for some time, and the party is clearly going to lead that debate. And then, of course, there is also the other strengthening, is the shift of the party outside the workplace. The party is classic Eastern European model of workplace-based. The problem with that, of course, is if you're not in work, you don't therefore have a role in the party. And so as the economic crisis retired large numbers of people, not least military personnel, what do you do with these people? How do you actually capitalize on them? One way of doing it is to allow party branches to operate, to be formed in the residential areas, outside the workplace. That was a very significant move, and it did have some change. It did make some changes to the party. And by the way, when we look at the party, remember the youth wing of the party as well. No one ever pays that much attention because it really has not had a very good history, the UJC, the Young Communists. That has gone through a significant period of change from 2000 under Otto Rivero, who people keep writing off, but he's still there. He's no longer head of the youth wing, but he's still around in the system and he's seen as a very highly efficient operator as having revived the party, and that's the youth wing of the party, and that's no mean achievement. But I would say go beyond that. Go beyond the party as well to the mass organizations, which again get dismissed very easily. But remember, the mass organizations for most Cubans are the way they articulate with the system. That's how they do it. The party is such a small membership that it can't be the party. It's got to be the other mass organizations. And there are three in particular I would point to keep an eye on. One is the old favorite, the Committees for the Defense of the Revolution, the CDR, the local neighborhood organization, which, of course, was fundamental to the system in the 60s and 70s, faded out considerably, almost stagnated, but is now starting to be revived again. Although I have to say it's about the third time it's been revived, so it clearly is there's something wrong with it. But at the same time, it's got a capacity, because it operates on every street level. Therefore, it has the capacity to still be the organization in which Cubans can be, or through which they can be mobilized, and through which they can have some sort of involvement. That's one to watch. The other is the trade unions. And the trade union organization is, again, something that gets overlooked, but there's been a lot of shifting around in the last few years under particularly the leadership of the current head of the CTC, Valdés Mesa. The unions have started to negotiate, have started to win arguments quite publicly, have started to campaign on certain issues, and have started to make a much more public, present themselves much more publicly as a criticism, as a critical force, and as representing and responding the workers. And that's part of that's of course their role, their significant, their official role, but they've started to act on that a little bit more. The final organization worth spotting is the Ex-Combatants Association, which was formed relatively recently, and precisely to pick up these retired military people. If you were suddenly cutting the armed forces by 50%, these people were simply going onto the retirement pile. What were they then going to do? Well, the organization that was created, the Association of Combatants of the Revolution, was partly designed to scoop these people up. And that actually is, I think, quite a significant organization and does play a role in all these discussions. That, of course, brings in the question of the old guard, the question of the old guard. Forget it. I actually don't think the old guard are all that relevant as an old guard. The problem is they don't all think alike. The fact that they were all ex-guerrillas, and we can name the numbers who are around, they don't think alike necessarily. I do think, and I do agree with Juan, that the question of unity was important, and that leads me on to the third point that I want to make before I finish, which is the constraints under which the system now operates, under which Raúl might or might not manage to change things. Raúl has to govern through negotiation, through balance. That's absolutely clear. Fidel had to as well, except Raúl has to more, because he lacks the authority, he lacks the charisma, he operates in a different way, and therefore I think that he does have to negotiate constantly. And I do think that the appointment, for example, the election of Marcelo Ventura as first vice president, which was seen by outside Cuba as a retrenchment of the old guard actually was an act of balance. It was to say to the old guard at the top and also at the bottom, the older ones, listen, we are going to reform, but we're not going to reform everything. We're going to keep the basics. It was a gesture, I think, more than anything else. And to keep people on side, quite clearly. And I think, therefore, that the negotiations with the CTC, with the trade unions, the negotiations inside the party are very, very significant. I think it's very significant that the party congress is going to take place at the end of 2009. Frankly, if I were Raoul now, I would have called it this year or early next year. The fact that it's going to be the end of 2009 means you've got a long time to get those debates sorted, to get those negotiations sorted, to get the people in place. Therefore, that will be a pivotal moment. It will almost certainly be Raoul's party as a result of the whole process that's being carried out. The other big constraint, of course, is the problem of the expectations. The expectations of Raoul amongst ordinary Cubans are unrealistically high. They are astonishing. I was there in Cuba just 3 weeks ago, and some of the rumours that were doing the rounds actively that you heard repeated were just ridiculous. I mean, frankly, you didn't have to be a rocket scientist to realise that no self-respecting government would actually do some of those things. And you realise a lot of the time the rumours were wishful thinking, what I would do if I were Raoul, rather than what actually is going to happen. But it does mean that the expectations are very high, that he will change things economically. That's the key thing, that he will make improvements economically. The problem he's got straight away is the world context. He's already warned about that. The world price is going up, which of course means that it affects Cuba directly given the amount of food it imports. Of course, if food prices are now starting to go down, that could make a difference again. Incidentally, not that affected so far by the world financial crisis. One of the great things about being cut off from the world financial system a little bit is, of course, you don't get to suffer from it. The other shock, though, is the other hurricanes. I was in Cuba. I arrived there just 2 days after Hurricane Ike had gone through, and the devastation was astonishing. Remember, it was not just one but two within a week, and one of those, of course, hit Cuba twice and devastated whole areas of agriculture. It was certainly a worry to them. It was really a demoralizing effect. It had a demoralizing effect on people who'd begun to think, right, okay, we're going to start moving now. We're going to start delivering the economic goods. Suddenly they realized, actually, they're not. And so the expectations, on the one hand, are very high. The ability to deliver, of course, is much, much less than it was. Finally, therefore, where does he want to go? Where does Raoul want to go? The answer is like a piece of string. It's whatever it takes to save the revolution. And, of course, you'll define the revolution depending on what the circumstances are. I do think he is extremely flexible, and he's known as a reformer and seen as a reformer. He's got a powerful base, of course, remember. He's got the armed forces. The armed forces are absolutely critical in the economy, critical for security, critical for legitimacy of the system as well. So he's got a powerful base there. After 2009, he'll have the party 100% behind him. So he'll have a lot going for him. Predictions? I don't think he'll go for a second term. I may well get that one wrong. I'm going to get one of these predictions wrong at some stage. That could be the one. I just don't think it's going to happen. I don't think he will go for a second term. So therefore, the next few years will be trying to work out who is going to be the one who will be obviously succeeding him one way or another. The other prediction I will make, incidentally, and you can tell me if I'm right or not on this one, because it's actually more down to you than me. The Cubans are not banking on the embargo being lifted, and I think they're right in that. They are assuming that the embargo carries on for another 5 years or more, and they're obviously operating on that basis. I think they're probably right there, but I'll stop on that.
I think you're probably right. Thanks very much. Marifeli.
Thank you, Peter, and thank you to Jessica for arranging my travel, which was faultless. Given that I'm traveling American Airlines, that's no small achievement. Before I start where I wanted to start, I want to react to... just to put it on the table, I have no way of confirming whether this is the case or not, but what I hear through people who maintain contact with their former colleagues in the Cuban hierarchy and are now in Miami, so we have to take it with a grain of salt. Regarding Fidel and his stepping down formally earlier this year from the presidency of the Council of State and the Council of Ministers, was that he didn't want to do it. and that it took a meeting with, you know, when Raul went to speak to him alone, he was saying, well, I could still, supposedly. And, of course, he can't leave his room. Raul then went to speak to Guillermo Garcia and Juan Almeida, who don't really have any power to speak of, but they are, along with Ramiro Valdez, I'd never heard the name of Ramiro mentioned in this context. They are the comandantes de la Revolución from the Sierra Maestra time, and that they had to convince Fidel that he could not be reelected. So we'll never know, because 2000, we'll never know. But I just want to make that, you know, the situation a little bit more complex, because while it was true that he was slipping, not only physically when he fractured his knee and part of his femur, but slipping mentally, he has this addiction to power, which people who are in power usually do. But in democracies, there are elections, and so the addiction has to end if you lose an election. The other thing, and this is where I wanted to start, is that, in fact, all that has been going on, you know, with what Juan mentioned, what Tony mentioned, all of this has happened before. There has been nothing new talked about by Raul Castro, whether it be in September of 2006 when he addressed the CTC Congress, the Trade Union Congress, and he gave a speech that in 1975, Lázaro Peña gave the old communist labor leader, Lázaro Peña gave in the 1973 Congress. The issue of corruption in the mid-1980s, there was a Granma editorial basically saying, we have to stop stealing. And, you know, so there, all of these things, all of them are we can comb through the past 50 years and find them throughout. The issue is that the only successful thus far effort to transform Communist Party-led systems have been China and Vietnam. The old market socialism in Eastern Europe worked for a while, but the only way, and then, of course, we could argue that neither China nor Vietnam are, at least economically, are socialist anymore. They are dictatorships with a market economy with tremendous problems, but also many achievements for ordinary people. And that mindset may be present, that is, trying to reform the economy, to open it up in meaningful ways, to empower Cubans economically, if not politically. It may be present, even widespread, at the level of, you know, people in their 40s and 50s who are the second and third tier of the leadership, but there's a resistance to that at the top of the leadership. So I like to look at what's been happening as having two bookends, the 2007 speech at the two 26th of July speeches in 2007 and 2008. 2007 was Raul's speech that talked about we have to have a public debate, listen to different opinions, and that's when he talked about Marabu, this plaga, this plague that takes over land, when people aren't working the land. I mean, anybody who knows anything about the Marabu and Cuban agriculture, in order to maintain your land, you have to be on top of it all the time. And what's happened with Cuban agriculture is really it is so shameful there is absolutely no reason why the United States should be providing Cuba so much of its food. Cuba is capable of being more or less self-sufficient in food. So that, I mean, that is an issue that may come back to bite the leadership. The failure of Cuban agriculture is, in fact, in Cuban terms, a national security failure, an embarrassment, besides. So in 2007, let's open up, let's start some reforms, and in 2008, drawing back. In fact, before 2007, between 2006 and 2007, Raul had to, a lot of things actually were happening behind the scenes. The most important was putting the house in some sort of order. Fidel left a chaotic government machinery because, in fact, he didn't pay any attention to the government. He paid attention to the people who worked with him and responded to him and were not part of any institution. So one of the first things that Raul did was disband this so-called Grupo de Apoyo al Comandante en Jefe, which, you know, they could go. They were the so-called young Talibanes, or relatively young Talibanes, who would go to the secretary, the party secretary in the city of Havana, and said, the comandante says X, Y, and Z, but we agreed to ABC at the last provincial party meeting. And so it doesn't matter. This is what the comandante says. So there was that type of chaos. It isn't a question of democracy. It's what Tony was pointing out, that in any bureaucracy needs to have some sort of relatively normal decision-making and relatively normal hierarchy. And with Castro, with Fidel, that was particularly after 2003, but this is also something that was repeated in the 1960s and that began to happen in the mid-1980s, and then it was corrected a bit. So, but Raul had to put the house in order. And again, obviously, it has nothing to do with a political opening, but it's making it also before 2007, Raul said at a council of ministers, don't come to me for decisions that you should take. You know, you're the ministers. You are the ones responsible. So regarding the gerontocracy, they have two motivations. It isn't just the question of unity, of the familiar faces, but also, given the chaos that Fidel left in Cuba, particularly between 2003 on, but again, throughout, in greater to a greater or lesser extent, if immediately the flag was passed to another generation, they would end up as fools in the eyes of history. So in some ways, I think they are motivated not for their individual place in history, but that the generation that made the revolution would pass on the flag or the baton to the next generation with Cuba in a less chaotic fashion than what Fidel had left it. The comparison, to the extent that we can make a comparison, and is not really China or Vietnam. And I had to ask Tony because I thought I would remember, and I realized I have forgotten. I was blanking out. It's really to the Soviet Union in the early 1980s, after Brezhnev's passing. That first came Andropov, who was an old man and lasted, I think, 14 months, but was a more of a reformer, his KGB credentials notwithstanding. And then came Chernenko, who was a mummy. So the question is whether Raul is going to be Andropov or Chernenko, because it is within the parameters of, you know, actually existing socialism, however we want to term state socialism, that the gerontocracy is looking at the problems that they are facing. I think Raul actually has leans towards Andropov, but we will see. Since the early 1990s, Raul has been talking about, you know, the frijoles, the beans, are a national security question. They are emphasizing housing, which was dramatically hit by the two hurricanes, but they have been emphasizing housing throughout, and they have not. I mean, the deficits are, just keep growing decade after decade. The oil and food prices, even though oil they get from Venezuela at very subsidized prices, nonetheless, both are worrisome for the leadership. Oil, because the Cuban leadership, the Cuban military, doesn't like Chavez. And also, to the extent that they bring order to Cuba, to the economy, to that extent, whether they try for it or not, they will be establishing distance from Venezuela, because Cuba will not be as interested, as Tony pointed out, in conducting the megaphone revolutionary politics in Latin America. But in that context of oil, it is estimated by people in the know that within 5, 7, 8 years, the combination of oil, the offshore oil that Cuba has that is very difficult to extract, and ethanol, that Cuba could be pulling in something like $5 billion a year from its energy sources, plus resolving its domestic needs. In that context, it is important that Cuba's relationship to Brazil. When Lula was in Cuba earlier this year and then said so, Amorim, the foreign minister, Amorim basically said Brazil wants to be Cuba's principal trading partner. Lula met with Fidel, and there were photos, and lots was said about what Lula said about Fidel, very nice things. But more interesting, and as far as I know, I have nothing has filtered, were the 4 hours that Lula spent with Raul Castro. And I suspect that ethanol came up frequently. So, yes, Raul is an institutional man, a bureaucratic institutional person, and I don't say that pejoratively at all. In fact, I say, thank God that he doesn't have charisma, because then he has to govern in a different way that is, even if dictatorial and not democratic, it is more conducive to tending to the needs of ordinary Cubans. The issue of Fidel, his presence and absence at the same time, this is really the worst possible scenario for them. Had he died in 2006 or in December, when apparently he really, a couple times between July and December, he was in very serious straits on the brink of dying. Had he died then, I don't know what we would be seeing now, but it wouldn't be, at least, and I don't think Fidel is calling the shots, but he is calling the shots on some things. For example, although he has a total aversion to any form of markets, he did sign off on the agricultural reforms and the selling of some of these consumer goods to a very small proportion of the Cuban population that has the convertible pesos to buy these items. Supposedly the government was ready to lift all restrictions, all travel restrictions. The only restriction would be that you would have to pay for your ticket with convertible pesos or have your relatives abroad pay your expenses. Fidel supposedly put his foot down on that. No, he doesn't want Cubans traveling. Well, you know. And also, there are observations made that Raúl Castro, in fact, wants to, at some point, and relations with Spain, as you know, improved since Zapatero became prime minister in 2004, but they have continued improving. And recently, Pérez Roque, Cuba's foreign minister, was in Madrid. The Spanish were saying to the Cubans, free the rest of the 75 from the spring of 2003. I think there are about 60 of them in jail right now. And apparently Raúl was ready to free them, but Fidel, again, put his foot down. No. And the argument that was given to the Spanish was that would be a concession to Bush. And, of course, you know, like McCain not being Bush, Zapatero is not Bush either. So that's that's... I think it is in those terms is the way that Fidel it still has a voice. But by the mere fact that he can't leave his room, that not that many people can see him, whether because he doesn't want to or because his immune system is weak and he can't be having all sorts of people coming in all the time to see him because anything can give him pneumonia or whatever, and of course, he is eventually going to die. My theory about the late 2009 party is that they're hoping that he's dead by then, but who knows? Let me just conclude with this. In the early 1990s, under Fidel, the Cuban leadership reached... three conclusions. One, they were not going to be like Gorbachev, who opened the economy and politics at the same time. We know how that ended. They were never going to allow the Plaza de la Revolución to be filled with people in protest, as happened to Tiananmen Square in 1989, and then Deng Xiaoping had to call out the tanks and the soldiers to disperse this mostly students and young people. And they were not going to hold elections that they couldn't guarantee, like what happened to Daniel Ortega in 1990. So they have conducted themselves looking at those three scenarios, and in some ways they can congratulate themselves that they have weathered stormy seas that nobody in 1990, or very few people in 1990, even those of us, in my case in particular, I never thought that the saying in Miami, en el 90, Fidel revienta, that it was going to happen. I mean, Fidel was not going to explode because the Berlin Wall fell. But did I think that 20 years later we would still have Cuba under this regime? I frankly did not. I didn't know when, but I didn't think that it was going to be 20 years, and it could be another 10. I think their blind spot is that, you know, history, you always learn your lessons for the issues that others have dealt that could be similar to yours. But you never learn a lesson for what unanticipated consequence is going to trip you up. And I think that because these are the gerontocracy, Raul, and the mostly senior men around him are conservative, with or without Fidel, perhaps in 2007, in 2008, Raul would have given the same speech, let's go slow. They have a sense, I think, a false sense of security that going slow is safer than going fast. Right now, after the hurricanes, which have caused at least $5 billion in damages, perhaps up to $10 billion in damages, that they're going to start slowing, putting their foot on the brakes of reforms. And right now, I think that that is a mistake. Everything that we know of what's going on in Cuba is that the hurricanes have devastated housing, agriculture, and the government is very slow to respond because the government, for example, in Holguín, in eastern Cuba, one of the places that was most devastated, there was an incident at a yogurt factory that because of the power being down, the yogurt that was already packed and ready to go was going to be spoiled, and there were, you know, 40, 50, 60 people went by together to the factory and said, sell us the yogurt. The answer, no, because we don't have any orientación to that effect. So they have to, in order to for Cuba to come out of this hurricane, a country that was fragile economically to begin with, they have to loosen the reins. And I don't think that they will, and that could be costly.
Thank you very much. I have a question for Professor Capsia and for Professor Del Aguila, following up on what Marifeli was saying. The scene presented is one of Raul Castro seeking to consolidate his position. He's already got the army. He's looking for the party. Old line, veteran cadres running the country. Minimal amounts of economic reform, keeping the lid on politically. Is this a formula that is realistic in terms of the old regime hanging on to power, or what steps need to be taken if they're going to try to hang on? Is the pressure building up underneath too great?
I think that's a fundamental dilemma of any communist ruler, young or old, that realizes the pressing need for reform, economic reforms, so as to improve the standard of living, but for psychological, historical, family reasons, is simply incapable of assuming the political cost of doing so. That's why they are proceeding so slowly. That's why they are proceeding so timidly. Because the scenario of Tiananmen Square and Wenceslas Square in Prague, like Marifeli alluded to, is right in front of them. Whether it's a mirage or real, it doesn't really matter. They have convinced themselves that rapid economic liberalization will invariably and in the short term will have negative political consequences for the system, and indeed will the Cuban political elite will go the way of the Eastern European political elites. And so the default strategy, which I think Marifeli is correct, is costly but rational, although that may sound paradoxical, is to manage these. After all, you know, the world, I think, we buying cell phones or is that going to shake the system up? Or even allowing peasants and farmers to farm on their own. A lot more needs to be done to make Cuban agriculture productive once again. Matafeli alluded, the United States has sold $2.2 billion worth of foodstuff, commodities, other grains, on a cash barrel basis over the last 5 or 6 years. At one point, Cuba was the United States' seventh largest purchaser of some of these commodities. So the argument about the embargo, I think, is a lot of it is just people that is not well informed. So, but the point that I think the point, the fundamental point, is this inherent and irreconcilable tension. If you let the economy go, are we going to be swept along when political demands crystallize for change?
Yeah, I think not disagreeing with that very much. I think that the sense I get in Cuba is that the what the average Cuban wants, and that's pretty general, I think, is an immediate economic improvement, not reform, not fundamental change, but improvement. And I think Raúl has picked that up quite clearly, and not what he is trying to do, and hence the reform, the changes to agriculture. I suspect he's going to move much more in the direction of more cuenta propismo, to much more self-employment and artisan activity. My guess is that. But then again, you have to always worry that, is it my guess or is it what I would do in his case? It's not entirely clear. But I do think that at the moment that I don't sense a pretty fundamental demand for political change. I really don't. I think if the goods can be delivered on the table quickly, then he's bought some years. I don't think there's a problem there. He knows he hasn't got the charisma. He knows he doesn't like charisma. He doesn't like speeches. He wants to deliver, and that his fundamental belief in systems is that systems deliver and that mobilization doesn't. And so I do think that he is focusing entirely on delivering those economic goods quickly, and therefore that's the priority. If he doesn't do it, he's got a problem. That's quite clear.
Maricel.
Yeah, two things. One is that I agree with Tony that probably Raúl will not seek another term. So that means that in 2013, he would be gone. I think the goal of the gerontocracy is to pass the baton in to a relatively younger generation and have them face the consequences of undoing the past 50 years. So that's it.
Thank you very much. There's certainly lots to work on for questions from the audience. Gentlemen here, please, if all of you could please state your name and your affiliation, please.
Perez from the International Monetary Fund and ASCII, the Association for the Study of the Cuban Economy. Thank you very much for the presentation. One thing that always surprised me about Cuba is why doesn't anybody, I mean, I know why, but don't you sense at one point somebody is going to say, the king is naked, this doesn't work? I mean, this talk about providing the goods on the table, they have 50 years of trying to do that. They haven't been able to do it. And it gets worse and worse. So don't you see any hope that in this process of political developments, there might be some groups that will start advocating more forcefully for change?
Do you want to take that one on?
Good to see you, Lorenzo. Look, I've been focusing now for some time on public lectures. I've talked to ASCII, as you know, writings, other colleagues. I have been focusing now for some time on elite behavior. That maybe puts me in a minority of analysts, but I have discounted for a long time now any kind of popular upheaval. You can argue with me on that. I can give you reasons as to why I think that option or that scenario is less likely to materialize than other scenarios that would propel the system in a different direction. The implication of your question is that at some point, some adult is going to come out of the crowd, right, and tell the gerontocracy, phone Fidel Castro, and tell the people, We have wasted 50 years. It's all been one big coña. Now we're going to straighten the ship. I don't think so. I really don't. These are creatures. There is no Gorbachev in sight. I don't see any Gorbachev. Last is no Gorbachev. Now some of these other lesser quantities may well be. They may harbor. They may be such a perspective. They may want to initiate a perestroika on their own. They may be convinced that it is necessary. But the system still has enough assets to crush any manifestation of division, disunity, and challenge to the top leaders. And as long as that is the fundamental rule of the political game that governs intra-elite behavior, I don't see it.
Yeah, I think what I would add to that is, just following on from what Juan said, I actually do sense that one thing we often overlook as well in Cuba is the extent to which the system does actually enjoy some support. We always tend to think that isn't the case, but it is. It is, besides the foot soldiers that I referred them, and I think they could go as high as 20-30% of the population who will turn up every time, who will deliver the goods politically, who will do that. I think there's a good another 30-40% or more who are willing to go along with it because they fear the alternatives, because they're worried about the emigres coming back, because of any number of factors, and the system's got that at the moment. The ones I think they should worry about, if they don't deliver the goods economically, whatever that means, is that middle rank, that middle group. I think they could lose those. I think Fidel was never likely to lose them, because that's when I contradict myself and say, of course, Fidel had loyalties. There were loyalties to him as an individual, there are loyalties to him as a leader, which Raúl doesn't have. So it is a different ballgame now. But I do think we overlook the depth of loyalty and the systems of loyalty which operate as well. So I don't think there's going to be a mass upheaval. No, I don't. I think there will be more and more complaining, but frankly, Cubans complain all the time anyway. I think that is actually, to some extent, the expectation and the hope. I think that Raúl is a remarkably flexible thinker. We don't tend to think of Raúl as flexible because he's bureaucratic and systems. He can't possibly be flexible, but he's the one who introduced the economic reforms in the armed forces. He's the one who actually was behind the economic reforms, or at least gave them the imprimatur, in the early 90s. He is prepared to do what it takes. He is the one who has already responded to the hurricane. There wasn't a connection, but he took the opportunity to say, will allow foreign investment into areas of mining that we didn't allow before. In other words, he is prepared to go beyond if the circumstances so demand. So I do think that consultation is giving him the ammunition to do whatever it is he wants to do. What he's got to watch is always the ones behind him who say, hang on, not too far. But it's the balance, it's that negotiation. So.
I do think that they are faced with, although I've been saying that they're talking about old problems, but the conditions are very new. And that in that context, Lorenzo, I think that they are already and will continue, especially because of the devastation of the hurricanes, to strike a balance between going fast and going slow, and that initially it is going slow, although on September 15th, after the hurricanes, the first applications for land by peasants and cooperatives began to be issued, and thousands of people applied to have their land. At the same time, they are responding with price controls and imposing all sorts of restrictions on the peasant markets. But so I do think that there is a dynamic that is no longer constrained the way it was by Fidel, and that along the way, I can't anticipate what that might be. They're going to be forced with very hard choices, and we'll see what happens. I do think that beneath the surface of a demoralized civil society, of people who are not don't see themselves as citizens, that's something very foreign to the way they conduct their lives. Cuban society is potentially a combustible society. I don't see it happening anytime soon. But there is a very interesting report by Freedom House published about a month ago. Wasn't a survey, but it was in-depth interviews with 180 Cubans in about five or six of the provinces. And they talk about three items that these Cubans brought up. Two of them political, but they don't call for democracy. The first is the single currency, which is a code word for their standard of living and the fact that they can't afford in convertible pesos, so the single currency. The other two are freedom of expression and freedom of movement. This doesn't mean freedom of expression to have a competitive, different points of view in the media or on television, but to be able to talk freely, not a small matter. And freedom of movement, not on the outside, to the outside, but within Cuba. And that is so difficult. And the other thing that struck me from the Freedom House report is that these 180 citizens, and they were in-depth qualitative interviews, identified the Communist Party as, not now, but in the future, as the medium through which change will come. So if we play a little bit with the looking forward, it could be that when they pass the baton to Velázquez or whomever, that could be a dynamic different from what we have seen over 50 years.
Got a question, the gentleman in the back, and here. The gentleman there, Jorge, the senore.
Hi, Peter. Yeah, this is Pete Romero, Experior Advisory. Marifeli, I was interested in your comment about the Cuban military and their attitudes towards Chavez, if you or any of the others would have any opinion on that.
Well, as we are all well aware, Granma doesn't publish these things. But that is the sense that people who study the Cuban military much more closely than I. The Cuban military, as any number of retired U.S. generals who have gone to Cuba in other times, it is a professional institution. It is also very politicized, which is a little bit contradictory, or a lot contradictory, but it is a professional institution. And under Chavez, the generals and the officers in the Venezuelan army have been weeded out, perhaps not entirely, but of the professionalism that existed before. Chavez has also tried, and I don't know whether only one time, but he has tried to give gifts to officers in Venezuela. And supposedly, of course, they're not. They know their own country, the Cubans, and as soon as they get to Cuba, they say, this is what happened. And apparently it happened often enough that Raul Castro, while he was still Minister of Defense, issued a national security order saying any officer who accepts any gift from any leader, any foreigner, at any time, at any place, will be charged with treason. So the Cuban military, Cuba-Venezuela relationship has been through Fidel and Chavez. The Cuba-China relationship has been through the institutions of the military. So I think that within the Cuban military there is, a reservoir of willingness to open up the economy more than it is right now. And that's anathema to Chavez.
Anybody else want to answer that? Here.
Norman Bailey, Institute of World Politics. Cuba can't feed itself and it has no insufficient sources of energy. It pays for the food it imports. It does not pay for the oil it imports from Venezuela. Venezuela has already informed the recipients of oil through Petrocaribe that that process may end because of the decline in the price of oil. And because Chavez is obviously more interested in using whatever money he continues to make from oil to maintain his internal control rather than helping people on the outside. If Cuba has to start paying also for oil along with food and with the devastation of the hurricane, what's that going to do to his possibility of improving the lives of the Cuban people?
Thank you. Everyone understand that? If Chavez were to alter his Petrocaribe plans and not provide subsidized oil to Cuba, how would that alter Raul Castro's economic outlook?
Briefly, if Chavez is indeed, as you suggest, forced to make that kind of a choice, he will suffer a tremendous loss of face at home with his own hardcore and especially international. Chavez, Marifel is correct, is heavily invested in his relationship with Cuba, costly though it clearly is. If he is forced back to cut back on this 100,000 barrels a day, that will clearly be seen as a political signal, as no longer having a good return on his investment. And I think he will have a substantial political cost for Chavez at home and in the region. The money is just not there. You're absolutely right. One of the lowest credit rankings in the world. Who could possibly loan money to Cuba and expect to get it back? Remittances have been cut back, which provided several $100 million a year. The sugar crop is now at about 1.2, 1.3 at best. In some years, they've actually had to buy sugar to meet commitments. Just that alone would set your head on fire, knowing that Cuba was a world-class sugar producer and exporter for decades. I think they're down to 51 sugar mills, maybe 42 sugar mills. The sugar industry, which was once the crown jewel of the Cuban political economy, everybody knows, is literally in ruins. They owe billions since the 1980s to European countries, to the former Soviet Union, and so to Japan, Argentina. And so it clearly, this is a debtor country. And that is why Perez Roque, Laje, and others go to Brazil, go to Spain. Can you offer some relief? I see no relief in sight. I really don't.
Hi, Kim Finch from the Department of Defense. I have a question for you guys. Since nobody really knows the true status of Fidel's health, how do you think his return to power would affect the Cuban populace, their psyche, the reforms that Raul is trying to implement?
He's not going to return to power. I mean, that's the short answer. At the end of the year, or next year, when there's the party Congress, I think that Raul will be the first secretary of the Congress. I mean, he's not. We don't know, but given, you know, the Cuban chisme, the gossip, is that he really cannot, he can't. He can't appear in public because of his the problems he has had with his digestive system, plus his immune system is very, very weak. So the issue is, I mean, let's put the ball in Raul's court, whether Raul is going to be able to do what is needed to alleviate the food shortages in Cuba and to give the Cuban people hope. I think that as long as they stay within the confines that they are in, it's going to wear thin. It's not going to happen.
Can I just answer that incidentally with one very quick anecdote, which is I was there in Cuba when Fidel appeared on television for the first time for 6 months. And it was really interesting to watch the reaction of the Cubans, the loyal Cubans, very activist, loyal Cubans. There's a mixture of relief that he was actually okay, but relief that he wasn't okay enough to come back. It was interesting, really interesting. None of them wanted to admit to that, but it was a sense, well, we actually do want to get on with it now, with Raul. But he's okay, that's fine.
My question is directed to you. Please say who you are and your affiliation. My name is Adrienne Daugherty. I'm with the Committee for Free Trade Unionism. And my question is directed to the last two panelists. Regarding the post-devastation and the hurricane and the trade unions and your discussion about the trade unions to keep watching them and their relationships with workers, I want to ask you about their relationships with the party and what specific evidence you have that they've been fulfilling demands for workers that would reform change from within rather than what we've also been hearing, which is contradictory, which is that Cubans are feeling more and more empowered to speak more freely and losing their fear of being too cautious. There's movement in different areas within the worker movements there. So a sort of a contradictory question for both of you to look at.
I don't think I said that, actually. I think what I was saying is that we must remember that the trade union organization acts as one of the negotiators in a system, and that it is now more responsive to grassroots demands than it has been. And I would go no further than that. I think that it went through a period in the 80s and then again in the early 90s when it stopped listening. It had other things on. It's now listening much more than it did and actually winning arguments. And they're not big arguments. They're arguments about postponing a law for another 6 months. It's arguments at that level. It's enough to give it legitimacy. It's enough to mean that, okay, it functions as an institution. But I wouldn't go any further than that. And I'm not sure that I would talk about empowering. I think that what's happened is it doesn't take much to get Cubans to complain, I have to say. And if you simply have, right, you've got five opportunities now to complain, then you complain about everything, including your neighbours. It's just everything comes out. And I think that's what happened in those consultation exercises. They were marshalled. I mean, it's quite clear. I was there at a couple of them, and it's quite clear that the chair in each case, two entirely different organisations, said pretty much the same thing at the start. So it wasn't a free-for-all. But the way it went, the way the discussion went, depended on what the organisation was. And sure enough, the trade union discussion was much more focused on trade union issues, on issues at work, not housing, for example. That came elsewhere. And so it's what I was referring to was the way in which the system does operate in these little safety valves, in allowing channels of communication. And I say, by and large, the warning is that we overlook it at our peril. There's something going on there. And we overlook it if we just assume that these are just organizations that operate from the top down and don't have any other function.
Give the time to the audience.
Okay. Let's see. Question here and then there.
I'm Ana Serra from American University. And I was wondering, now that Cubans are under the regime of Raul Castro, and he's promoting all these ideas of unity and discipline. And what was the other one? Unity, discipline, and
order.
Yes. What became of the battle of ideas? What kind of discourse is being promoted? What are the sort of catchphrases in the battle of ideas right now? Or is there no battle of ideas that is noticeable?
My answer to that is actually evasive. It's still going on officially. It's just it's being downgraded. And the people who are involved with it have been downgraded. One very publicly 2 weeks ago. Hassan Perez lost his job as second secretary of the Young Communists. But as I say, Otto Rivero's still there. He's still there, and he's the one most associated with it. And I think the point is that when I talked about the alternative strategies, actually, it isn't clear-cut, one's Fidel and one's Raul. They actually do agree, by and large, that, okay, it's time for one or time for another. And I do think that the battle of ideas served a purpose. It actually did function in some ways quite well politically. The economic costs in the end turned out to be far more damaging. So it's still just about there and not lost. I mean, I'm not saying the battle's not lost. Sorry, it's a bad term there. The idea hasn't gone away. And I suspect that we will still see it in a couple of years' time. It'll be resurrected from time to time, but the emphasis has gone.
Mark Sullivan from Congressional Research Service. I have a question, two questions really, related to the dynamics for change in the future. For example, what would your views be if Fidel were no longer on the scene? How would that have an impact on the terms of the go fast, go slow approach? And also kind of related to that, but probably more broadly, what would be the effect on the dynamics for change with a new U.S. administration?
Fidel is one pillar of the go slow, so, and obviously a very important one. So when he dies, I think that frees up the dynamic to follow its own rhythm, so to speak. I think that people will be, for example, the issue of the political prisoners, I think, could be more readily, at least of the 60 from the Black Spring of 2003, it could be more readily resolved. But also the issue of broadening the cuenta propistas that, I mean, I hope that they do that, but I'm not sure that they're going to do that anytime soon. So, and with the United States, if Senator Obama wins the White House, he has said that he will lift the travel ban for Cuban Americans and the restrictions on remittances. People say that that's not enough. But given how stagnant and how polarized, in my opinion, in the wrong direction, the U.S.-Cuba relationship has been in the past 8 years, arguably with problems before as well, lifting the travel ban for Cuban Americans and the restrictions on remittances is a huge thing. It is a huge thing. I'm not sure that Raul Castro's government will be able to receive as many Cuban Americans who want to go to Cuba as often as they can. So, I mean, that is a huge, to speak the language that we have been in the past few months, that's a game changer. If Senator McCain is elected, he is bound to more or less the policy as it is now, though I do hear that there could be a lifting of the 2004 restrictions that made Cuban family travel very strict to the direct family line. Cousins and aunts and uncles are not family. The same restrictions on remittances. So instead of going once every 3 years, you could go once a year and more flexible remittances. So I think that the Cuba's problems are due to Cuba. The U.S. has provided Cuba with a wonderful crutch for decades. And even the minor lifting of restrictions on travel and remittances could be very powerful now because of the very new conditions without precedent in the past 50 years.
Yeah, excuse me for being a cynical Brit. I would say don't hold your breath. I really would. I think that I don't detect any sense in which it's going to change fundamentally. However, let's face it, I mean, if years ago I had been, we keep saying, if I were Raul, I would do this. Frankly, if I had been any American president in the last 40 years, I would have lifted the embargo, and that would have destabilized the system immediately. No question. I mean, Marifeli is right. It has actually worked far more in favor of the system than it has against. Economically, extremely costly, there's no question. Although there is, of course, now a lot of food coming in from the United States. Nonetheless, the effect on investment and so on is just catastrophic. But they've got used to it. They've worked out systems. And, of course, politically, it is extremely powerful. So, sorry to be cynical, but I don't think it is an issue at the moment, at least. I think it's an issue in 5 years' time, maybe, or something like that.
The embargo, but not the travel ban to Cuban
you.
Americans. And I'm saying that that is a big, that is a game changer. And the other thing, Cuba has run its economy to the ground. Vietnam was embargoed by the world because of Cambodia, and Vietnam started a serious restructuring of their economy. Cuba hasn't done that. So that's why I emphasize that it isn't just the embargo, it is the policies that the government has followed.
I want to make a brief comment. I know we have to go. On the first part of the question, I'm not getting into the second one. Look, be careful what you wish for, Raul Castro, because the good cop, bad cop routine will end once Fidel is out of the way. Right? Be careful what you wish for. Now, reforms, well, he's against reform, so we can't proceed anymore. Every time I make an announcement, he refutes it. Battle of ideas, when I really don't really pay much attention to, be careful what you wish for. Because once, presumably, that barrier or that countercurrent or that line of different thinking opposed to whatever Raul and all of the reformers want to carry forward is no longer there, then nobody will blame Fidel Castro anymore. It is Raul's ballgame. It is Raul's ballgame. And then he can no longer play this good cop, bad cop routine, that if he's not playing it, his policies and the fact that Fidel Castro is still alive has that effect and creates that impression. My friend Brian Latell wrote a piece, "The Era of Raul Has Started." And I was telling Tony at dinner last night, yes, but the era of Fidel has not ended.
One last question, gentleman in the back here, and then we'll have to break up.
The gentleman ahead of me, excuse me, Wayne Smith, Center for International Policy. The gentleman who was sitting ahead of me, but who's now left, was noting that the Cubans, despite the fact that their system hasn't worked very well over a period of 50 years, with some alterations, and now hopefully Raul will make some changes in the agriculture, but minor ones. So they stick with the same system without change. Why? When it really doesn't work. Well, we must be mirror images of one another, because the United States has stuck for 50 years to a policy that not only does not work, but actually, as the speakers have suggested, actually in many ways is helpful to the Cubans. And I agree with you. I don't see any basic changes in U.S. policy at this point. Lifting the travel controls for Cuban Americans is good, and I agree with Marty Feli, but why? Cuba poses no security threat whatever to the United States. The objections that we used to have are no longer there. It's no longer trying to turn the Andes into the Sierra Maestra of Latin America, and yet we seem incapable of any kind of change in this policy. So is it we've, to some extent, hypnotized one another?
Wayne, nice to see you. The United States and Cuba, if we were talking about two people, they have an entrenched, impossible codependent relationship. And so I don't know what is needed. I do know that over this past summer, and now I've been working on something on U.S. And Cuba, and I was struck by the 1970s that it wasn't just Jimmy Carter and the opening of the interest section that you were so involved with, but it was actually Ford and Kissinger before that. Without the legwork that they did, Jimmy Carter would have started from zero, and he didn't because of their work. And when the State Department officials who would who were first going to start meeting with Cubans at, you know, LaGuardia here and under President Ford, Kissinger, I mean, they had a memo that laid out the policy that was wonderful, except that 30 years have passed and nothing has been done to move the U.S. Kissinger said something that I want to that I'm going to be using all the time now in what I'm writing, and he said to his people going to meet the Cubans for the first time, do it like a big guy, not like a shyster. And that's something, I mean, for Cuba and the United States to move out of this impasse, both have to move out of the corners that they are in. The United States has to turn off the microphone and engage in diplomacy. And Cuba has to come to an understanding that this is 2008, almost 2009, and that issues of domestic issues like political prisoners and a criminal code that criminalizes political, speech activities. Those things are going to be raised not only by the bad guys in the United States, but by the so-called good guys in Europe. And so both countries, both governments need to make some adjustments if they are serious about ending this sick, codependent relationship.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you. Thank you very much. The bottom line in all of this is how to promote a transition to democracy in Cuba. That's the key fact. Cuba is and remains an aberration in our hemisphere in terms of an authoritarian government that has persisted for more than or almost 50 years now, and I think the objective that everyone feels is, you know, what is the best means for helping the Cuban people to regain the kind of democracy that they deserve and that other citizens of the Americas share. It's a topic that our program here at CSIS looks forward to continuing to work on. We're very grateful for the distinguished panelists for their comments and for their answering questions, and I'd be very grateful if all of you would give them an expression of your thanks as well. Thank you very much.